been voting here since the second.
All right, it's Bob Fetrakis and Harvey Wasserman broadcasting on radiofreepress.org. Or is it radio.freepress.org? Somebody help me here. Where's our
sign?
Well,
we're on the radio. What the heck, you know?
We're streaming.
Streaming and streaming here.
Yeah, well, we'll have to get the staff to tell us whether it's radiofreepress.org. And a little delayed feedback here in the studio.
That's good.
All right. A lot of things happened this week, including the passing of Free Press columnists and syndicated national columnists, Pulitzer Prize-nominated columnists, and original, and a friend of yours, Harvey, Molly Ivins.
Well, Molly was a great, great person. I knew her for many years. Very wonderful hostess and friend. Brilliant, brilliant woman. Personal acquaintance from high school of George W. Bush. Uniquely qualified to be in Austin and to comment on the incredible comedy that was what she called the ledge, otherwise known as the Texas legislature. She basically said she didn't have to make up anything. You know, it just came to her in the proceedings of the bozos who came to Austin to legislate Texas into oblivion. She was a uniquely funny, perceptive commentator on American politics and life, a brilliant, brilliant writer, beautiful woman, just completely irreplaceable. It's a terrible loss. She struggled with cancer three times. She had it. She beat it. She got it back. She beat it again, and it came back still again. And, you know, there's just never going to be another Molly Ivins. And the night she passed away, I kind of wandered around the house in a daze. To lose a friend like that and to a national commentator of that range and importance and with that kind of following with her politics is just an irreplaceable loss. So, Molly, if you're listening, call in. We really need you. We really need you here.
And again, Molly, actually, I hung out with Molly at your house after she'd been at
right.
the Columbus School for Girls.
Well, we played basketball.
We played basketball. And, and not only that, she's tall.
She is tall.
And not only that, she knows her way around the basketball court.
That's right.
She was as tall as I was. Oh, 6 feet.
Yeah, she's no messing with Molly. She had a good hand-eye coordination there, had formidable
and
elbows.
Wasn't afraid to use the... See, I wrote that on my blog. I just, you know, needed you to confirm it as a friend. You weren't, she wasn't a pushover.
No, not hardly.
I mean,
you know.
She had her space on the court.
That's right.
If you had to take it from her.
That's right. No, she was a jock, as we like to say. Had a great pickup truck which she drove around Austin. It was one of the only pickup truck of that ilk that had no gun rack. But tremendously gracious hostess, all the Southern.
And as I recall, she liked long neck beers.
She was a big fan of long neck beers. She's the only woman to ever smoke in my Volvo. You know, she just, there's just no. I spent a lot of time with her over the years, and every moment with her was a joy. And it's just.
Well, in many ways, I mean, she really was elite in her formal schooling, but
right.
I mean, she was the editor of the Texas Observer.
Yeah.
I mean, so she ended up writing for, like, the New York Times and editing
right.
the Texas Observer,
exactly. Yeah.
Which is sort of like the Free Press model.
Yeah. No, it was – she she went to Smith College. Her father was a wealthy Texas, you know, very conservative businessman. She said, I read in one of the many obits that, all her ability to fight came from standing up to her father, which I could see. And, I actually met Molly for the first time. She didn't remember when we became better acquainted, but, in 1980, she was in the Denver Bureau of the New York Times and, came up. We had a survival gathering with the Native Americans in, South Dakota. against uranium mining. And I was working with the Indians there, and she came up, and we just hung out, and she did the interviews. And, you know, she was way cool back then, and I got to know her more at some conferences we went to together. And, you know, stayed at her house in Austin. It was a very nice, you know, gracious house, comfortable, but, you know, very much a part of the Austin community. You know, it's just not even conceivable to invent another Molly Ivins, and I wish
and it's
gone,
a writing
frankly.
Style, I mean, which we should talk. It almost, while I wouldn't call it gonzo journalism, it's really kind of populist muckraking. I remember one of the first columns I ever read that she wrote had the kind of following in there. You know, I was on the, you know, I was down on the Texas Legi today on the forum watching debate, and, you know, a man from a representative from Waco turned to a lobbyist and said, "That bill was such a stinkeroo, you're going to owe me two hookers tonight." And then she writes, and then when I printed it in the Texas Observer, next time he saw me, he came up all excited saying, "Molly, you quoted me in your paper." Just as gracious as could be. And you're thinking, what's up? You know, like in Ohio, I mean, look.
Right.
I mean, right. Our legislature has been known to be set up with hookers. The whole thing is that you don't do it openly.
Right, right.
It's like, that bill was a stinkeroo. You're going to owe me a couple hookers tonight instead
well, I
of
think
the usual.
That he was excited because he was proving to his constituents that he could handle
two hookers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just like Representative Charlie Wilson, right? The legendary representative who gave us the war in Afghanistan secretly, who kind of once complained there was no one on the ethics committee that liked pussy and whiskey. It's a Texas thing.
Well, yeah, but you know, Molly made it a national thing, and it's just so amazing that she was on the scene. You know, one of those great serendipities that she was on the scene to comment on national politics when her high school cohort George W. Bush brought the apocalypse to Washington, you know, and she was.
And it's only fitting that she was the jock and Shrub, a term she coined,
right.
Was the cheerleader.
That's right. That's right. And,
at least as he went on to Yale.
That's right. And he was also, she also coined Dubya.
To Shrub, Dubya.
And, you know, her spinoff style, I mean, you got to think of, who's the woman that writes for the New York Times, the columnist, kind of a paler northeastern takeoff on Maui, Maureen Dowd.
Maureen Dowd.
Yeah, she's kind of a northern knockoff of Molly, but not close, really. Molly was just in a class by herself, and she was only 62, you know, and it's not a kind of thing where, well, you expect it, and I mean, she should have had another 30 years. So it is a huge loss. And
we've been publishing her at the Free Press consistently now, you know, since the mid 1990s,
right.
1995.
Right. It was a great coup that you got to you know, get her her column. I mean, that was a wild.
Well, for a brief period of time when we were gonna shut down, we didn't renew her column, and it diverted to the
Columbus Alive. No.
Columbus Dispatch.
It did?
Who never
never ran it.
They had, you know, when I called up to get it back, they said, "Well, the Columbus Dispatch has it." And luckily we fell into a different category. We were a monthly at the time.
Uh-huh.
So since we were only running it monthly and we were running it online, but the Dispatch had it. I don't know if they still had it when she died.
I never saw her column in this.
I think I saw it in there once or twice. It kind of popped up.
Well, she was syndicated to 400 papers, you know. She was the only legitimate leftist that had a mainstream circulation.
Which really wasn't the case back in the 60s and into the 70s
no.
when Michael Harrington was syndicated to dozens of newspapers. And another fact of history, Norman Thomas was a syndicated columnist in the 50s and into the 60s.
He was both a syndicalist
and
a syndicate.
I don't know about Debs. Debs may have been a little bit much.
Yeah, right.
He was syndicated to the syndicalist.
Yeah, death was carried, I'm sure, in every socialist paper. I mean, back then.
Oh, appeal to reason, sure.
Sure. I mean, back then you had a socialist
network. You actually had a huge socialist press, which, you know, you had, I think it was somewhere in the range of about 800 of them got shut down during World War I alone.
Yeah.
Under the, you know, the 1917, Sedition Act and the use of the post office to suppress anything that was radical.
Right. But, you know, Molly, was right at home in any living room, basically, and exquisitely funny. She was great on television, great on panels. Just a totally gracious person. And,
I know. I can still see her there drinking a long neck, and you were having, as I recall, a yogurt fresh berry affair. The Odd Couple.
Yeah, right. Well, I did share one fantastic moment with Molly, my twins at the time were about 5 or 6 years old, and they were just getting used to their training wheels. And I was walking with Molly around the neighborhood, and the girls were in front of us on their two bikes, and suddenly they turned down an alley and just disappeared. They just rode off in the distance, and Molly, you know, said, well, you know, they're done. You're gone. Now all it is send the money and hope they write, you know. So, Molly, you know, it's just this is one of those moments you just can't even begin to describe. And we just wish you weren't gone. Your impact has been amazing. And I do want to mention one thing. Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Brown, while Molly was in hospice, went to Jackson's studio and sang to her over the phone. I thought that's one of the most amazing things you can think of. So thank you, Bonnie and Jackson, for doing that. And Molly did hear them, and, you know, I don't know. It's just no replacing her. I don't know.
There's you know, a couple of earthly angels there, Bonnie and Jackson
right.
Brown. I mean, just have done incredible work over the years. And Jackson Brown, I mean, really underrated. Took a tremendous amount of
grief
over what he did in Central America during the 1980s.
Yeah, he wrote one of the great songs, I think, of all. It's hard to even call it a protest song, but Lives in the Balance.
That album was incredible.
Yeah,
that and The World's in Motion. Lives in the Balance was really, as an album, just unbelievable. He went down with the Witness for Peace people, and how dare a musician artist actually see things with his own eyes,
right.
Harvey?
Yeah, well,
I'm sure the CIA, State Department bulletins would have sufficed.
Yeah, right. That's right. Jackson, actually, I hadn't heard the album with Lives in the Balance on it. And I read a review in People magazine, panning the hell out of it. And I said,
this must be great.
You know? And, you know, anything Jackson does is great. But so I went and got it and wrote a great review.
Some of that stuff he did in the 70s, I was a fan of his, but some of those really long kind of like depressive, you know, the ones where he was like reflecting existentially on life.
Yeah, you know, but that, you know, that's great. I love that stuff. It's great. And he wrote, wrote a few of the songs that the Eagles did. But I have a live album of his, I saw him play. He played here in Columbus at, on campus at Mershon, and he played solo. And he came out with his 12 guitars and just sang for 2 hours all by himself, and it was spectacular. Just absolutely spectacular. And, he's an incredibly talented guy. And so, you know, this moment of Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Brown singing to Molly Ivins, it's just, pretty amazing to contemplate. So, but Bonnie and, I mean, Molly, we just, miss you. We just wish you were here. And,
if you want to read some of Molly's stuff.
Yeah, we have it archived on
freepress.org.
The free press, so.
And it'll stay there. In perpetuity till the fascists come in.
Oh, no, I think the fascists are on the run now. We've got
good.
You know, I love this flap this week about Joe Biden. You know, he makes a statement. He puts in a single word that's out of place, and the whole world goes crazy. I mean, here you have Rush Limbaugh every day saying the most vicious, racist things. And, you know, one of the networks actually put Rush Limbaugh on talking about Joe Biden. I mean, I have no patience for Joe Biden.
A drugged up sex. You know, then he had to go out and get some drugs and sex
break. But Joe Biden, you know, here he's, I think he's, you know, he's all right as a senator. I mean, he's long-winded and
incredibly so. Yeah, they used to time his questions.
Right.
The opening question from Chairman Biden. 5 minutes 47.
Yeah,
he's
right.
Just legendary for
right. Not
you
a
know,
chance.
I mean, he should have been a Trotskyist. I mean, like, have you ever been to a conference where the
well, maybe he was,
where the Trotskyist you know, no, that was the neocons were the Trotskyists.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Literally.
Well, Biden has no chance whatsoever to be president, but, you know, to just have this national furor over a misstatement in his talk, I find it a little off-putting, because they can do that to anybody, you know, they can always find a little flaw. The thing is that Biden has no...
Well, they can
no
find the flaw because they control the airwaves, right? I mean,
Biden has no history as a racist. I mean, if somebody who was really a racist said that, that would be one thing, you know, but... to me, it was a waste of time, but I do find the thing with the mayor of, San Francisco, Gavin Newsom, who, has had an affair with his campaign manager's wife. This is a little, I mean, can't these guys, control themselves in the middle of a campaign, you know, or be a little more discreet? Find somebody other than your campaign manager's wife to sleep with. I mean, I'm reminded of the great quote from Yasser Arafat when he was sitting in the White House waiting to meet with Bill Clinton, and the Monica Lewinsky story broke, and his quote was, "Why doesn't he just get a goat?" So, anyway, but this is what seems to be taking up our time. I will say I was stunned to see a poll in the Columbus Dispatch, a statewide poll that showed Hillary Clinton leading both John McCain and Rudy Giuliani in a you know, preliminary presidential contest. You know, everybody who's saying that Hillary could never win had better think twice about that. If we're seeing her ahead, and of course it's early, and any Republican is going to be in the dumps thanks to the, you know, incredible crew that's in office now. But I think it was the first time really snapped to my attention the fact that she could actually win. But, you know, I think that this talk of diversity, I mean, one of the advantages Hillary has that people don't, you know, really give much credit to, or enough credit to, is she is a woman. We've never had a female president. We have a majority of female voters in this country. A majority of college students are women in this country now. A majority of law students are women. And, you know, we've had the 19th Amendment on the books for 86, 7 years now. It's about time it actually took place, and got some traction. And I think that anybody who's dismissing the idea that if Hillary gets the nomination, she'll lose, maybe not paying attention to the state that the Republicans are really in. And you got Rudy Giuliani, who is womanizer is kind of, the New York Yankees of the Yankee Clipper, I think, of womanizers in the Republican Party. You got John McCain, who has some compromised positions now in Iraq. He continues to support this war, which is beyond belief as far, for anybody who was ever in Vietnam, as far as I'm concerned. And beyond these two frontrunners, you know, shy of Jeb Bush, God forbid, you got Sam Brownback running, the extreme right winger running from Kansas, and not much else. I wouldn't write Hillary off at this point in time. She's not my, you know, I'm a Kucinich supporter, and, behind him I support John Edwards.
And behind him, I think, Wesley Clark, but that's sort of my order of stuff.
Well, that's,
like,
yeah.
Kucinich, Edwards, Clark. And part of my problem, of course, is, Hillary, you know, I think she's electable. I think you're right. She might pick up, you know, at least 5% just, on the women's vote.
Right.
Maybe double that. Maybe as much as 10%
right.
Because it's historical. But my problem is she vacillates so much on Iraq. I mean, she's now being attacked from the right by Cale Thomas and other people
right.
on her Iraq position, which is really a bad
position.
Position, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you've got the same problem with Obama, who's supporting
right.
the surge as well. What do you make of that?
Spinelessness, you know, traditional Democratic unwillingness to stand up and take a stand. You know, I have to have a lot of admiration for Dennis Kucinich here. He came right out and said he's running for president, you know, and is, unwavering in his positions. Takes great positions, still pushing a Department of Peace, which I think eventually will happen, and clear on the environment, and, you know, just doing it the way it should be done. And You know, the media loves to scorn him. I was just on a show here in Columbus, WSU, one of those, you know, bloviation sit around the table. And, you know, a guy, a Republican consultant says, well, of course, nobody takes Kucinich seriously. And it's ridiculous. I mean, here's the man who saved the Muni Light. Then he starts talking about how Dennis bankrupted Cleveland, a complete lie, you know, which he's going to hear the rest of his life, even though he saved, Cleveland from...
Well, it was a banker's, strike, right? There was a capital right. strike in Cleveland.
Right.
As they tried to pressure this man into selling, Muni Light in Cleveland,
right.
into doing the bidding of the corporations.
And he refused. And they said basically either you sell the municipal light system or we're gonna, put the city in receivership. And he said, you know, I'm not gonna back down. And that's why, you know, is there a mystery why he's in Congress? What is he, 4, 6, 8 terms now? I mean, he's been in a long time. I think it was 94 he was elected.
Well, they said he was done in politics and then he came back and was a state rep and then a
right.
state senator and then a U.S. representative.
Well, I think he's been elected 6 times now. I think it was 94. He was the only Democrat in 94, as I recall, to take a seat from a Republican.
Right.
And that was in the sweep, you know, the Clinton healthcare disaster, midterm disaster there, and that brought in the extreme right wing. And Dennis is the only fish that swam upstream. And now he's in charge of he's got the Government Operations Committee. He's in charge of the, you know, many of the regulatory bodies that make our lives possible here. So,
does the Nuclear Regulatory Commission fall under that?
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact. And I'm glad you brought that up. We had in town here a visit from the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission who was out promoting this so-called renaissance in nuclear power, which is a complete hoax. There is no renaissance in nuclear power because there's no money in nuclear power. It's a financial disaster, a bottomless pit. Nobody in Wall Street wants to invest in atomic energy. It doesn't work. It's dangerous. It's the ultimate weapon of mass destruction being handed to terrorists. There's no way to prevent or to protect a nuclear plant from a terrorist attack. And we had the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission here talking about this renaissance in nuclear power. Excuse me. He is promoting a technology that he's supposed to be regulating. And, you know, it's absurd. And so we just had a commissioner who is leaving the commission, a guy named McGaffigan, come out and say basically that Yucca Mountain, the nuclear waste dump, sorry, is not going to open for at least 17 years, by which time there'll be twice as much nuclear waste around as Yucca Mountain could handle. It's a big blow to the nuclear industry. Very few people are paying attention to it, but it's important to know.
Well, what about the McNuke strategy of those new and improved
right.
fast food nuclear regular?
Well, the best thing about those reactors is that they don't exist. You know, they're strictly on paper. It's wholly a whole big scam, is to say.
I'm not so sure, though. It never stopped Reagan and others from building hypothetical Star Wars weapons
right.
and people getting incredibly rich. So you don't mind that? I mean, it's almost better that they're hypothetical and people
might
get paid to build them than they actually exist online.
They can have all the McNukes they want as long as they don't build any. You know, I mean, they're all on paper. They're theoretical extractions or extrapolations of fantasies on the part of nuclear backers, and it's ridiculous. We have a booming renewable energy industry in this country. Wind power is just leaping ahead. Solar energy with photovoltaic cells and parabolic trough mirror collectors, power towers, biofuels. You know, we have a big biofuel push for corn ethanol and soy diesel, and you know, in the interim, it's okay, but corn and soy are not going to be used for biofuels. They're
perennial. They're totally inefficient. I mean, corn. Well, ethanol isn't the 10-to-1 mix.
Well, yeah, and yeah, ethanol you only pick up. There's a lot of arguing.
Or sometimes 14%.
Yeah, there's a lot of arguing about how whether ethanol really provides an energy gain. Given how much fuel goes into raising
sure.
it. And Lester Brown, who knows this stuff from used to be with World Watch Institute, now he's got another one, says it's about 1.5 to 1 energy gain from ethanol versus energy input. So it's a, there is a return. It's much better on soy diesel. But, neither of those is going to be around because ethanol will be made with perennial crops that you don't have to plant every year and that you can't eat. For example, hemp,
switchgrass. Which is an excellent, excellent source of fuel.
Absolutely. I mean, right. Plus it's, you know, nice if it's being used in a car, for example, to drive behind and, you know, contact, I know they won't do it that way, but, you know, hemp, switchgrass, poplar trees, there's a new, crop called Miscanthia, not new, but I mean, it's being newly used. These are all perennial crops. You don't have to replant, you don't fertilize, you don't use pesticides, herbicides, they can take, there are weeds, so you don't have to get rid of weeds to grow them. And, corn will not be around very long as a source of ethanol. And when we get off corn for ethanol and get into cellulosic ethanol, which is the, when you use the stalks and everything else of these fast growing crops, That's where the future of energy will be.
Well, what do you make of the Columbus Dispatch? I mean, front page, massive headline on the climate report from the scientists, toned right. down by the bureaucrats. And then again today, you know, dire predictions of weather changes, the tornado, of course, in Florida.
Seven
I mean,
tornadoes.
There's a big debate. How much time do we have, and is this the moment for the switch?
Well,
I mean, if you got mainstream newspapers, Republican-owned, thought to be right. conservative, kind of finally, you know, I mean, it was never in dispute, right? Because every single scientist, I know there was a study in Science magazine and in others, every scientist believed in global warming. There was some incredibly minor debate about whether it was naturally occurring
right.
or being speeded up by humans, but there wasn't any
right.
reputable scientists that said global warming wasn't occurring, right?
Well, I mean,
even though there was corporate scientists that were right. manufactured, and they were always quoted one-to-one. But, you know, the real scientists, even the ones that didn't think it was man-made, weren't disputing global warming was happening and we had to do something.
Right. Well, the one piece of data that nobody disputes is the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. You know, for carbon dating and for the kind of research they can do to go back to see what the carbon dioxide levels were, we know that the industrial revolution has had an enormous impact on the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, what the byproducts of there are, is what's being debated. I don't believe that global warming is the right word. It's really climate chaos because you don't have a
uniform, or as you've called it and others, global weirding.
Global weirding, which
yeah,
I
because
first heard
I mean, 11. We're in trouble. I was talking about this with Suzanne today, my wife, and we were thinking is that. We're not exactly sure where we want to retire. You go up north thinking right. there's global warming. You could be in the new ice age
right.
because that was triggered during the, because the right. climate changes in the world, the currents, the wind patterns, that conveyor belt that keeps Europe so warm. And quite literally, you know, the northern, including Ohio, may be plunged into ice while it's much hotter at the equator.
Well, actually, this film, The Day After Tomorrow, which was, you know, kind of hokey in its way, but it did show a widely agreed a scenario that people are widely agreed could happen, which is that with global warming or with the warming up of the northern reaches and the melting of the ice caps, the dumping of non-salt water, fresh water, into the northern oceans could affect the Gulf Stream and drive the Gulf Stream south, in which case you would have the northern
as the cold water sinks to the bottom and sort of cuts off that conveyor belt.
Cuts off the conveyor belt, right. So
of the warm currents coming up from the equator.
Northern Europe and northern United States thrown into a deep ice age by global warming, which is counterintuitive, you would think, but that's why global warming is not quite the right name. And if the Gulf Stream is disrupted, you know, here in Ohio, certainly all across Europe, be tremendous chaos, make the place will be really unlivable, and you may be, you know, pretty crowded on some small islands around the equator.
Well, we were thinking about Tennessee. I mean, it's got mountains.
Uh-huh.
It's got some water.
Right.
I mean, and it could go either way.
it
could go either way. We're not, or New Mexico. I mean, we're worried it could get too hot, but you got some mountains in New Mexico.
Yeah, although
and you got some lakes.
The water supply doesn't look too good, you know.
Oh, in New Mexico.
Yeah. So who knows?
About one of those lakes up in the mountains.
The big issues are going to be water. Actually, a lot of the rivers are
drying the Great Lakes is a good region.
Great Lakes is good, yeah, although cold. it's hard to pick, you know. It's hard to pick a spot.
So what you're suggesting, it may be like the Upper Peninsula, the UP of Michigan.
Something like that.
Only colder.
Oh, pretty cold up there.
So this means that the Scandinavians will end up
running the show. Well, they have all that wind power anyway. Denmark and, you know,
so that's not bad.
That's good. It's good for Denmark and to have wind power. But, the fact is that we don't know what's happening. We do know that we are having impact. We do know that, the other big thing, the other night I watched these right wingers. There seems to be no shortage of them. This Kudlow. Is that the guy's name?
Yeah.
And, he had,
I'm a mean right winger.
How
do these guys get shows? I mean, what are their credentials?
I know. It's amazing.
Yeah, they find them raving against liberals and bus stops, urinating against walls. Go, this guy is crazy.
He's sleeping under bridges.
Liquored up. I'm liquored up and I hate liberals.
Right.
And I'm a misogynist.
Well, he had
cool. You get a show on MSNBC.
Right. He had PJ O'Rourke on there. Who's just a total creep. And all these, right wingers.
And then they also, Tucker Carlson.
Oh my God.
I'm a fop. I've got a nice bow tie.
Yeah, right. A total moron, airhead. So you have all these, babbling idiots on television talking about Adam Smith as if they know anything.
Adam Smith is not a guy you want to read in great details about the joys of capitalism because he was very frank.
Yeah.
I mean, one of his is that most workers will end up working repetitive jobs and become dumb as oxes.
Right.
Or David Ricardo on the Iron Law of Wages. The natural tendency of capitalism is to pay the vast majority of workers subsistence wages.
Right.
I mean, it's like, you know, they talk about capitalism. The neo-capitalists like George Gilder, who kind of like, capitalism is
right.
A gift. It's a gift relationship. But, you know, the real capitalists like Adam Smith and Ricardo write very bleak things about workers under capitalism.
But Adam Smith also warned very, very early in The Wealth of Nations against large monopolies, which have now become corporations, of course.
And the only thing that contained capitalism was they needed to be within localized markets.
Right.
So the morality of the local market could control the natural tendency of the capitalist to maximizes capital.
That's right. And Smith warns really pretty much on the cover page of Wealth of Nations that monopolies could completely screw up the system and that you can't allow big companies to take over. And all these schmucks out there who are, loving Adam Smith, work for big corporations who are doing precisely what he warned against to the economy.
Well, thank God the oil companies made a little profit.
Yeah, well, you
39 billion, was it?
Yeah. Well, we'll get them off welfare. I mean, the CEO, I don't think we'll have to have his food stamps renewed. But,
So you don't think we're going to have to give those corporate subsidies to Exxon?
No, but we'll see. You never know. I mean, these companies are so badly run internally. I think, personally, the multinational corporation is going to go extinct. It's ultimately too big, too
destructive,
unwieldy, too corrupt.
And the movie The Corporation, which one of my best documentaries ever made. I mean, they argue if you look at the tendencies of a corporation and then get out the DSM-3. I mean, essentially, they're psychotic. I mean,
yes, right.
They're antisocial personality.
That's exactly right.
By, you know, with no
sociopath.
Feelings. Sociopath. No feelings, no conception of empathy for other entities.
Right. Only one agenda, which is money.
Maximizing
and,
money.
Which ultimately doesn't work because, you can't sustain that in a world that has a little more complexity than that, you know. And, the original corporations, in this country, in the United States, the time of the revolution, there were 6 corporations in the United States, and they were all chartered locally.
Right, and they're still chartered at the state level. The problem is that in the old days, you used to be chartered for a specific purpose,
right.
Like to build
a bridge, a toll bridge across the Ohio River, and you'd be restricted to $3 million of capital and to operate, to build and operate a toll bridge.
Right.
And then what happened is the New Jersey Charter, which was essentially you're incorporated for any lawful means, which became the Delaware Charter.
Right.
And in Ohio now, I don't know if you know this, but under law in Ohio, is that you don't have to fill out the purpose of your corporation. If you leave it blank, it's assumed to be, quote, for any lawful purpose,
right,
the Delaware Charter.
Right.
And the mob likes this.
Sure, the mob, the drug dealers.
Yeah, you get about 12, 15, 20 dummy corporations, and the assumption it's for any lawful purpose, and you kind of play a shell game and move the stuff around. But now there's no restrictions on capital. I mean, $39 billion in profit in one quarter.
Jeez. Yeah, and you know, of course the corporation, charter, the model corporation charter was pretty much written by Standard Oil, John D. Rockefeller in the late 80s, 1880s, and, they came in and hijacked the 14th Amendment. And that is really the
charter. Well, yeah, based on a mistake initially by, a private recorder at the Supreme Court.
I'm not sure it was
which established.
he may have done it on purpose.
On purpose?
Yeah.
The corporate personhood.
Right.
But really it was, it was a mistake in the way that it was not the ruling.
Right.
Right.
But we've never had a ruling.
His intent may have been.
Right.
To put that in there, but it appeared not to be the court's intent.
Right.
To give essentially constitutional rights.
Well, humanhood.
Yeah, well, non-natural persons.
Right.
Well, there's natural persons, that'd be me and Harvey, and then there's unnatural persons. And by God, Exxon needs its constitutional rights.
Well, you know, of course there was always that.
Including its right to move to Cayman Islands with other corporations and pay no taxes.
Exactly.
Because they're patriotic.
So, you know, these bozos out there are claiming Adam Smithhood with their bow ties and their offensively superior demeanor, really ignore Adam Smith. And it's important that we restore Adam Smith to his, rightful place, you know, having written The Wealth of Nations in 1776, simultaneous with the Declaration of Independence. We need to retake that rhetoric. But I believe, and you hear it first, I think that the multinational corporations are going to start to disintegrate. They cannot, and with Enron, and, you know, this is the age of Enron.
Well, if that were true, we'd look for trouble at General Motors and Ford.
Well, gee.
Ford, which has set I think that was a record, right? It's in terms of losses.
Losses, yeah. I mean, it's amazing. The oil companies are making all the money, and the automobile companies are going down the toilet. And
I know. It is very, very ironic. And part of the problem is actually not this year, but last year when Ford lost, whatever it was, $9 billion. I'm losing track these days. But
yeah.
A few years back when General Motors lost $4.5 billion, mm-hmm. it actually would have made about a billion and a half in profit if one thing was in place in the United States that's in place in every other industrial democracy in the world.
National health care.
That's right. I mean, the reason they lost money.
Right.
And they've lobbied in the past against Chrysler didn't under Lee Iacocca. Lee Iacocca kind of, when Chrysler was going bankrupt, said, hey, he actually kind of suggested he was a social democrat.
Yeah, well,
he's going like, how can I compete? How can I compete with Canada in Japan when they have essentially this subsidy through universal health care to all its workers? Because the cost of all those retirees who get health care and decent health care.
Right. It's a catastrophe, a national catastrophe. And Hillary, you know, coming back to where we started, is partly responsible for that. She did have a moment, where we could have had a pretty good debate nationally on healthcare, and they really would not deal with single payer issues, you know, as you recall. They had this incredibly ridiculous.
Which is what the majority of people wanted. In fact, there's a very famous quote from Hillary when she's being presented the options and, the story goes, it's like, okay, most Americans would like a simple system, affordable to everyone, paid out of taxes, which would be the single payer system, and keep the doctors private. And she goes, yeah, well, tell me something new. So what?
We've been trying that since 1947. And, you know, Truman essentially proposed a national health care system and couldn't get it through Congress. And ever since, there it is, you know. And it's a national disgrace. You have how many million children without health care, people choosing every day between heating oil and, you know, illness It's absurd, and it's going to kill us as an industrial competitor. I assume the Chinese have national health care.
Health insurance.
You know, and
but don't worry, we're exporting those cigarettes. We should balance it out. And yeah. That's the big market for all those cigarettes you can't sell here anymore, the ones that are all kind of doctored up with formaldehyde, 13 chemicals, and
yeah.
injected with 8 times the normal amount of nicotine.
Nicotine, right, right. No, it's a sad situation here, and we're gonna have to deal with this. I don't know who's gonna come in the White House. We do know that, it's looking pretty interesting from this Scooter Libby trial as to,
well, because it goes right up to Cheney, right? If you look at, have you seen the notes that they've entered in his exhibit?
Right.
It looks like what we thought all along, Dick Cheney put it into play, and it may go right to the president himself.
Well, if the president, who is the president anyway?
President Cheney.
Oh, President Cheney, that's right. No, I mean.
And his lap puppet.
you know, all the conspiracy theories are true here. They did out Valerie Plame with the specific intent of paying back Joe Wilson and shutting him up, because of his criticism of, the Iraq, well, the false assertion about uranium purchases and the weapons of mass destruction.
And she was in, Valerie, Plame was in counterproliferation. I mean, which mm-hmm. Was interesting because I had an article that actually got picked up in the, Rand Times where there was speculation that, the administration was just about to find some old nuclear weapons,
right.
You know, or material in either in Syria or in Iraq, and say it came into Syria from Iraq. So one of the stories out there, and the historians may end up answering this one, is she may have disrupted in part that counterproliferation. And by Wilson coming out and telling the, you know, truth of the story that somehow they got this through Niger, you know, et cetera,
right.
They disrupted this whole cover story that could have allowed, because the U.S. had access to certain Soviet nukes that had been dismantled from some of those republics in Central Asia. I remember a long time ago you wrote that story on buy those nukes.
Right.
Right after the Soviet Union collapsed.
Right. And the U.S., of course, didn't take me up on it. Big mistake. I remember, you know, you have those moments. I was riding in a rental car outside of Las Vegas into the Red Rocks National Monument, which is absolutely gorgeous. And local NPR was interviewing Seymour Hersh, Cy Hersh, who broke the story on the memos showing that the whole cover story of Saddam going to Africa to buy uranium was a hoax. And I'm listening to this interview, and as I go into the mountains, the signal disappears, so I had to turn around and drive back out so I could hear the rest of the interview, which was one of the most shocking moments, I think, in the whole sad, sorry history of the Bush junta here, is the profound contempt for the good faith of the American people to float this story about Saddam having nuclear weapons of mass destruction and buying uranium, knowing it was a complete falsehood.
Well, you had to worry because Pakistan could end up with them if Iraq.
Right.
Okay, a little insight.
Well, the latest one, actually, this is a mind boggler. Last week.
What next, Korea?
No, what next, actually, Syria. Well, the press is now speculating that the Israelis have actually been trying to cut a deal with the Syrians to establish relations with Syria, of all people, in exchange for the Golan Heights, which really no longer have the strategic value that they used to, given, you know, advanced weaponry. And that the administration, the Bush administration, has been sabotaging this attempt by the Israelis to make peace with the Syrians because it casts a different light than they want on the situation in Lebanon and Iraq. And this is one of the most astonishing things that I've read in a long time. The idea that an American administration would want to prolong the warlike atmosphere between these two, timeless enemies is astounding to me. But what a breakthrough that would be if the Israelis were able to make some kind of deal with the Syrians.
And well, and I remember the astonishing stories. I heard Cy Hersh on the radio during the, early days of the war against Afghanistan when he was being leaked to by the special forces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the fact that we flew, the Pakistani Al-Qaeda on military planes. And we're talking Al-Qaeda here. Out of Afghanistan, back to Pakistan. And we only went after the Arab Al-Qaeda and the Afghanistani Al-Qaeda. And these troops were, and they were also complaining as they weren't allowed to drop on the other side of the mountain to cut off bin Laden and Al-Qaeda.
Right, right.
It's just like, okay, you could only stay on the Afghanistan side. You,
right.
You know, this international, you know, terrorist criminals escaping, but we're going to let them because those caves at Tora Bora, right, they ran right through the mountains, right? You go to the borderline where the mountains are, and your caves come out on either side, right?
Just it's like Yucca Mountain.
Yep.
And all that nuke waste. But it is a sad, sorry history, and I think finally with the Democrats in Congress, some of these guys are going to have the backbone to really pursue some of these issues. And, you know, the only bad thing about the diminished time left with George W. Bush in the White House is that it doesn't quite make sense to impeach him because there's just such a small window there.
Well, now you sound like some of the people on John Conyers' staff and perhaps a little like both of them saying is that by the time you gear up, do everything, get the trial,
right.
It's not going to happen.
Maybe
and then like his daddy on the way out the door, you can just pardon everybody.
Right.
I mean, which is...
including himself.
Right.
I pardon me.
Can you pardon... I mean, that was a big question with Ford. Can you pardon somebody for future crimes?
Boy, I don't know. Can you?
Well, that
we should ask...
Because Ford kind of pardoned Nixon for crimes and any future crimes relating to Watergate.
Right. Right.
But if there's no crimes that have come against you, Bush, you'd have to... I mean, have to be kind of a blanket. You know,
right.
All future crimes, including, you know, if I kill Laura and the girl.
Well, I think we should really consult with the true legal genius on these issues, Alberto Gonzalez, who,
the president cannot be charged with any future crime and any present crime involving torture unless a major body organ fails.
Right. And I think that probably.
Is the brain a body organ?
The one of the great moments in all U.S. history is the seeing the blank stares on Arlen Specter and Pat Leahy when Alberto Gonzalez announces for the first time in United States history that the Constitution of the United States does not guarantee habeas corpus. I mean, how do you top that moment? You know, it's like, hello.
Let's be fair. It simply says in Article 1, Section 9 that the writ can't be suspended.
Right.
Does it actually grant the writ as an affirmative right, I ask you?
Well, I think it assumes that we're born with it. I mean, you know.
Well, that's an assumption. You know what they say about assume.
Yeah, right. I mean, when the First Amendment
says... Does it ever say the right of habeas corpus belongs? It says it can't be prohibited. Written there, you know, just
right.
Like Congress shall make no law.
Right.
It doesn't say you have a freedom of speech. It just
now,
says,
let's get this clear. When it says that Congress shall make no law.
Does it say the president shall make no law? No. There's my argument.
Yeah, right.
Muy bueno.
Yeah. So when the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law, bridging the, you know, the freedom of religion and the separation of church and state and the right to free press, speech, assembly, petition the government. The assumption is, and as I'm sure our interview with Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and Ben Franklin made clear, is that those rights are yours when you're born. And now,
well, you're going to start talking about
Gonzalez.
Inalienable, unalienable.
I mean, come on.
Can't be taken away right. Kind of stuff. Yeah.
So along, stuff that comes from the creator with a capital C.
Except the
nature with a capital N.
Yeah, the universal. But, you know, but it was interpreted early on, though, is that the state could take them away. I mean, it's not really to, you know, the 1920s that we begin to get those and the famous, dissents on, on the yelling, you know,
fire
in a crowded theater or war in a crowded fire.
So Alberto Gonzalez has decided that these rights are not inherent, in the U.S. Constitution or given us by God or Mother Nature. And so I think, you know, that George W. Bush, would find in Alberto, certainly able counsel to defend himself against anything that, he might want to do for future life and certainly getting away with, whatever he's done now. It is a shame though, because the impeachment impeachment trial of George W. Bush, which I don't think is going to happen. I mean, I would love for it to happen anyway. I just don't think these guys are going to do it. But it would be, especially now, we've had seven, witnesses contradict, Scooter Libby's contention that.
Well, what if it does go to the president? What if it goes from Cheney to the puppet? What if he was pulling the strings on the puppet and the puppet did in fact say,
yeah,
let's put this into play.
Is
that not an impeachable offense? Is it not a high crime, a felony to out an undercover CIA agent?
Oh, most definitely.
In a law passed by his daddy?
A lot more clear than the Bolton Amendment, for example. But, is he going to get away with it? Does he remember?
Harvey Wasserman making obscure references to Iran-Contra, the Bolton Amendment.
That was the Bolton was Zoltan Amendment.
I'm voting for Zoltan.
Yeah,
which we should do a whole show one day on Zoltan Ferenczi. Because he's such an obscure but great figure in America, really Michigan politics.
Right. Well, he's kind of the Millard Fillmore of
I love, but Zoltan Ferenczi was like a real radical, progressive socialist that went into very, high levels. It was Michigan Democratic Party chairman.
That's right.
And one of my political mentors, I might add.
There you go.
So I want you to retract that Millard Fillmore comment.
Oh, I will retract it. It's just I was listening to a tape, and the tape talking about 10 most obscure presidents that we've had, and start off by saying that you can no longer consider Millard Fillmore because he's the touchstone to be obscure because he's the touchstone of obscurity, and therefore by
he's
his
become well known.
And there's, of course, the great rock and roll arena, the Fillmore West.
And who was our bachelor?
That was James Buchanan, our first gay president.
Harvey Wasserman, as a historian, goes on the record. Next thing you're going to tell me that Hoover and Tolson were gay.
Well, they weren't, they certainly have nice taste in evening dresses.
Well, J. Edgar was thought to like to cross. He I understand he did this feathered boa was one of the things
that
he
was
really
a big
liked.
Thing, yeah. He wanted to look
and a strapless.
Yeah, and a strapless. He looked good, bare-shouldered, apparently, but... getting nauseous here. But anyway, let's go back to impeaching Bush. I think that the Congress is going to find so much stuff out of the Scooter Libby trial that there's going to be a real question.
And you're not saying that a first gay president in a bad way. You're saying that
he was happy.
Positive.
He was happy. Let's put it that way.
But it's good thing we had a homosexual president that we don't really admit to.
Well, he was gay. James Buchanan, at least 50-50 appears in the historical record, was of the happy persuasion. He was a gay guy. He did have a live-in lover who was a slave owner from the South, who moved out for some reason. I think he failed in re-election. I can't remember what the details were. And Buchanan writes letters about how bereft he is to lose his roommate, as it were. But the thing about Buchanan...
Just like Roy Cohen when he lost his lover to the military anyone to make love to when they were looking for communists under people's beds.
That's right, and they wouldn't let the guy out Friday night for his passes. But the thing about Buchanan is that the reason he said his homosexuality has been so hushed up is that the conservatives don't want to admit that we've had a gay president, and the gay community doesn't want to claim James Buchanan because he's such a rotten president. I mean, if you're going to have your first gay president, he should be at least, reasonably competent, but this is not the case. So to get back to Bush and impeachment,
we're all obscure presidents, but what about Pierce? I mean, that's the guy hiding it. Wasn't he brought back? Was he the one brought back from England?
I don't remember, actually.
Yeah, one of them was the ambassador to England, and no one knew where he stood on anything. They brought him right back before the Civil War.
Well, my favorite, of course, is William Henry Harrison, who ran as a Whig in 1840 and stood and legitimately stood for nothing. There was no Whig platform.
Was he Tippecanoe?
He was Tippecanoe. And
Tyler, too?
He was also the inaugurator of Tecumseh's curse. William Henry Harrison defeated Tecumseh at the Battle of the Thames River in 1813, and Tecumseh, the great spiritual leader and chieftain of the Shawnee from here in Ohio, they've never found his body. Harrison was beside himself looking for Tecumseh's body, but they spirited it away, or it just went into the atmosphere, whatever. And in 1840, William Henry Harrison was elected president, Tippecanoe and Tyler too, and gave a 3-hour speech at his inauguration. in the freezing rain, caught pneumonia, and died a month later.
He was the oldest president at the time.
Our greatest president.
Up to Ronald Reagan.
Oh, he was? Yeah.
Yeah, he was. I think he was like 69.
Oh, well, he was a geezer then. But at any rate, when he died, they said it was Tecumseh's curse because he had defeated Tecumseh but never found him. And since that time, every 20th year until Bush, the president in office has either died or been shot. You had Garfield, or both. Actually, you had Garfield, who was shot in 1881.
Well, yeah, you had Lincoln in 1860.
In Lincoln the first in 1865, the first president assassinated. Oh, he was not the first to die in office. Harrison and Zachary Taylor died in office. But then 1881, James Garfield was shot and died. 1901, William McKinley was shot and died. 1923, Warren G. Harding died of food poisoning, and some say it was his wife, the Duchess, who was angry over his well-publicized dalliances with Nan Britton, his mistress. 1940, Franklin Roosevelt, reelected in 1944, died in April of 45. And then John Kennedy, of course, elected in 60, died in 63. Then you had Ronald Reagan, elected in 1980. Reagan was shot in 81 by that Bush family associate.
And a little Alzheimer, so it's sort of like it kind of had that whole Night of the Living Dead quality during his
exactly.
last term.
The question is, did he really survive? And then you have 2000, and George W. Bush is still with us, you know, and the clock is running on Tecumseh's curse, so he may break the curse, we'll yet see, but we'd certainly like to see him impeached. I mean, I would not consider extending his term a year so we could impeach him. I don't think it would be worth it, but I think an impeachment...
Give me time to invade both Iran and Syria.
Right, and Canada even.
Well, they're socialist.
Yeah. So I think, an impeachment...
We'll bring Canada democracy.
an impeachment of George and Canadian bacon too. an impeachment of George
W.
Bush.
Michael Moore, only non-documentary Michael Moore ever made.
Canadian it was bacon. A great one. I love Canadian bacon. It's a great movie. But I think the impeachment of George W. Bush would be extremely interesting. It would unearth so much amazing stuff, not only about the weapons of mass destruction, the outing of Valerie Plame, the whole setup in Iraq, what the oil calculations really have been, the relationship of Rumsfeld and all these other guys to Saddam. I'm sure there was plenty of communication between George and Saddam before this war broke out. We really need to get to the bottom of that.
Right, and we're wrapping up here. We only got a few minutes left coming up on the hour mark. Our producer was suggesting we do a half-hour show for iPod purposes, but between the two of us, we're kind of the Joe Bidens of
right.
Can we owe an apology to Mr. Biden for making those 5-minute questions?
Right, into 10-minute comments there. But I don't know why Biden ran in the first place. Any pollsters?
He wants to say that he ran for president. He was doing darn good among most of his family.
Right. No, it's a waste of his time, waste of all of our time.
You remember when he was like young and dynamic, pre that unexpected stroke he had at one point in the hair plugs. I mean, Joe Biden, he's been in the Senate for
forever,
30 years or something. Yeah.
He was very young. Hasn't been there as long as Bob Byrd, I don't think, but, he's coming up on it. He just stay where he is and keep asking long questions. I think his candidacy for presidency is only going to be a joke.
Well, with John Kerry having dropped out, there's a shock.
Yeah. Well, where's the $7 million John Kerry owes us for investigating?
Investigating the
Ohio
04 election.
Who's next to be indicted, by the way? Where are the next indictments going to come
in? Well, I'm lobbying hard for Coshocton County, and I think we'll write something on that this week, Harvey.
I think Coshocton is the only county that actually counted all the votes.
We'll tell you why they counted all the votes, because they pre-counted the votes. And
before.
And then they realize at one point, hey, this may be illegal.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, we better count them all because what we did was just illegal.
Well, the question is the office of the new Attorney General of Ohio, Mark Dayan, going to follow up on all the tremendous election fraud that occurred in Ohio and really track down the indictable offenses of the 2004
disaster. We'll see how much resources they actually have to do that. They're really not set up to a great extent to do this, but they've indicated they'd like to work with citizens groups, where maybe the citizens groups, and that's where that John Kerry $7 million,
yeah,
where we could, you know, help them develop evidence. They're not really geared up to do a lot of prosecution, but they can. And I think, you know, we could help unearth this stuff as we come up.
Well, on this show, I think I'd like to promise our listeners that we will be soon deposing all the 87 county boards of election executive directors.
Particularly if we get some settlement or get some cash in.
Sorry,
the biggest problem is
he
actually is like, well, I think we don't even depose Matt. We just lure him out to a restaurant. Say that. Well, what's that one in Jersey? Schnitz.
Promise
of
the
how would you like some Wiener Schnitzel and some Bratwurst and Hasenpfeffer, or you talk? No Hasenpfeffer till you talk, Mr. Damn Schroeder.
And we promise him a $10,000 check for the Republican Party as long as he takes it in his office.
That's right.
With another man of substantial physical presence in the office.
Yeah, well, Big Patsy Galena. Pasquale. Okay.
So, all right,
wrote that check to Matt. Well, we've wrapped up on another show, Harvey.
Yeah, another fun time here in the brand new shining offices here at the penthouse towers of the Ohio Fire Department.
We're on the street level, but we do have a tower. If it had a floor, we could climb up to
that's
the tower.
Right. But we have a wonderful southern exposure here in the 0-degree weather in Columbus, Ohio, and
with an Arctic front coming through.
Really, quite impressive. It reminds me of growing up here, where temperatures actually went below zero. We need a foot or two of snow on the ground, and you could actually think it's pre-global warming.
I'm thinking snow forts, and we used to build snow walls for the, you know, and then we'd pour water on them to ice them.
Right.
I used to use my cousin to try to knock him down when we were in the middle of snow battles. My cousin was rather large. He was about a year younger than me. The Rock! It's like, push him through the snow fort. But yeah, you get your snowballs, and ice balls were technically illegal because they put out your eye, but.
Well, small detail. But let's put out George W. Bush. I think I changed my mind. Let's impeach him. Get Scooter Libby and Judith Miller and the rest of the sorry crew in front of the national cameras and find out what really happened.
Yeah, we want to see the perp walk.
And Molly, take care out there. Come back soon.
Okay, freepress.org. Check out the writings of Molly Ivan, our hero, recently departed. Peace.
Stay tuned for some easy listening jazz on freepress.org radio. A rainy November 2004. Shortly after, we will also feature some old archives from other radio programs that were recorded, including an archived Bob and Harvey show, and anything else that we can find in the file bin. Second World War.